Hello again, this is Brian McClanahan, and today we're going to talk about the 1840s and a couple of very important presidencies in American history. And that would be the presidency of John Tyler and the presidency of James K. Polk, both of which, of course, had a tremendous impact on the future of the United States. Now, John Tyler is often one of those guys that's considered a bad president. If you look at a list of from historians and they take a survey as to who are the best presidents in the United States, John Tyler usually is either near the middle of the pack or near the bottom. He's one of those guys that's kind of seen as a do-nothing president, a guy that wasn't a strong executive, didn't abuse executive authority, and that's principally why he's usually near the middle or the bottom. But I actually consider him to be one of the top five presidents in American history because he did not abuse executive powers. He did not abuse the Constitution. He did what was in his constituted authority for the most part. I think that you could maybe make a case with Texas and the way Texas was brought into the Union. However, John Tyler was a really important guy and a transitionary figure in so many ways as we're starting to look at the 1840s, 1850s, and then into, of course, the war between the states. The other guy is James K. Polk, and of course, Polk is often considered as one of these forgotten but great presidents because of the way he used executive authority. And I think you can see in Polk the groundwork being laid for some of the abusive executive powers that we'll see later on in American history. And Polk, in so many ways, championed Andrew Jackson. Now, Andrew Jackson rhetorically sounded great, sounded a lot like Thomas Jefferson, but Jefferson he wasn't. And of course, the way he used executive authority is definitely in a way in which Jefferson would have condoned, wouldn't have condoned. So, Polk is one of these guys again who is often seen in maybe in the top half of American history, presidents in American history because of the way he used the executive branch. But I think that there's some critique to be made here. Now, the reason this is often called the end of the age of Jackson is because James K. Polk, the last president we'll talk about in this presentation, called himself Young Hickory. He was Jackson's protege. This is a guy that was Andrew Jackson light, so to speak, when he was in the executive office. He wanted to be like Andrew Jackson. He considered Andrew Jackson his hero. When he was in the House of Representatives as Speaker of the House, Andrew Jackson was his guy. So they're both from Tennessee. So in that way, Polk is the end of the age of Jackson, so to speak. Now let's start with John Tyler. John Tyler, of course, was from Virginia. He is an interesting guy. He lived until 1862, and he was the only former American president to also serve in the Confederate States in some capacity. He was actually in the Congress of the Confederate States. So this is a really interesting fellow. He's a Virginian to the core, and when I say that, I mean he's really following the traditions of old Virginia. He would assume office in 1841 after the death of William Henry Harrison. Now, just give you a little background here. William Henry Harrison, of course, was a Whig, and that's what John Tyler called himself, a Whig. And I'm going to talk about what that term means. But first and foremost, Harrison is going to be elected in 1840. At that point, he was the oldest man ever to be elected president. Now, Harrison was a war hero. He had won the Battle of Tippecanoe, the Battle of the Thames during the War of 1812. Battle of Tippecanoe, of course, before that. And he is elected in 1840 in what, in many ways, was the first modern campaign. And I say that because of the way the campaign was organized and put together. On the side of the Whigs, you had a Whig party, and they were following very much in the footsteps of the Democrats, who had started organizing conventions. Now, the Whigs actually ran a campaign that we would recognize today. For example, they had campaign slogans like Tippecanoe and Tyler II. They called it the Log Cabin and Hard Cider Campaign. So the little songs, little jingles to go along with this stuff. They had an image created for William Henry Harrison. Apparently, this is the guy that liked to sit in the log cabin and drink hard cider, whereas Martin Van Buren, his opponent in 1840, was the king. He lived in the palace. That's what they called the White House. Of course, Van Buren was still president. He ate off of gold spoons and rode in royal carriages. And so they're really trying to portray Harrison as a man of the people. Vote for this guy, you're voting for the people. Vote for Van Buren, you're voting for the aristocrats. Of course, Harrison was from a very prominent American family. He was a medical doctor. This guy wasn't poor, but he was portrayed as this frontiersman, this rugged individualist, and in some ways he was. I mean, he did spend a lot of time in the Indiana Territory. He was a great Indian fighter. But again, it's image over substance. And this is why Harrison, when he was elected in 1840, decided to give the longest inaugural address in American history to that point. And unfortunately, because he's an old guy, he gives this address on a very cold day in Washington, D.C. It's raining. He decides not to wear his coat, and he catches a cold, and then the cold will turn to pneumonia, and then Harrison will die. So now we have a crisis. This is the first time in American history a sitting president has died. Well, what are you going to do? We know we have the vice president. We know in the Constitution the vice president will assume the duties of the president should the president not be able to perform those duties. So we all know that John Tyler is going to be president. In fact, he's informed of the fact that he's going to be president while he's playing marbles in his home in Virginia's plantation. So he goes to Washington, D.C., and he's informed by the cabinet there that, look, Tyler, we're going to take over things here. You just kind of sign off on what we're going to do. But Tyler was his own man. He said, no, that's not the way it's going to work. I'm president. I'm going to do what I think is in the best interest for the country. And you're going to follow my lead. And we'll talk about this in a minute and how this created a rift, in the Whig Party. But Tyler was his own guy. He's very independent. And he actually served his entire term without a vice president. So this is, again, the first time we've had this situation. A lot of people thought maybe we'd have another election. Maybe John Tyler would just be there for a little while, again, a rubber stamp, and then we'd have another presidential election. But that's not the way it worked out. So Tyler is really setting a precedent here. When a president dies in office, the vice president assumes that term. That was not something that was so clear in 1841 when Tyler becomes president. Now, I mentioned that John Tyler is a true American Whig. So let me talk about Whig, what this term means. Of course, the Whig Party goes back to the presidency of Andrew Jackson. Andrew Jackson was seen as a king or a dictator by some people in the United States, particularly those in the South, because of his actions during the nullification crisis in principle. But also, the opponents of Andrew Jackson, when he vetoed the recharter of the Bank of the United States, and then his actions after that, when he withdrew all the money out of the bank and put it in his pet banks, et cetera, et cetera. They looked at those actions as dictatorial. Here's a guy who has no regard for the Constitution. He doesn't care about it, just runs over it. Of course, he ignored a Supreme Court decision. So you have this opposition party form in the 1830s, and they call themselves the Whigs, but they really stole that name from... and of course, it's a slap at Jackson's face. The Whig Party in England was the anti-monarch centralist party. Sometimes they're called the Country Party. But the thing is, the American Whigs, for the most part, the driving forces behind the American Whig Party believed in centralization just as much as Andrew Jackson. They just didn't like it that their guy wasn't doing it. So these Whigs really weren't Whigs at all. There was no opposition to centralization there. There was no opposition to a strong executive as long as their guy was in office. And of course, the best expression of that, even though he was never a Whig, he was a national Republican, John Quincy Adams. This is before the Whig Party, but people like Henry Clay, who was a driving force in the Whig Party, loved John Quincy Adams. And John Quincy Adams wanted to centralize authority all he could. So they, if John Quincy Adams could have had his way and been a strong executive, they would have been all for it. So Tyler, though, was a Whig in the truest sense. This is a guy that opposed executive authority and the abuse of executive authority, no matter who you're talking about. And they opposed a strong central authority. They believed in states' rights. And in that way, they were the true country party. So when Tyler assumes office, you have this Whig agenda, which is the Hamiltonian agenda, the Hamiltonian economic agenda, which Henry Clay called the American system. And they're going to try to ram this thing down the throats of the American public in 1841. And Tyler's going to start vetoing all their legislation. And this really ticks them off. For example, he vetoes a recharter of the Bank of the United States, or I should say a new Bank of the United States. This would have been the third Bank of the United States. He vetoes it. And it just... The Whigs go crazy over this. They can't stand it. He did it twice, not just once, but he vetoed it twice. They go crazy over this. They can't understand how this guy, who's a Whig, supposedly would veto what they want. Of course, Tyler thinks the bank is unconstitutional, as had virtually every Jeffersonian from the time the first bank was chartered in 1791. Tyler opposed a protective tariff. Well, this just takes off all the northern industrialists who want this protective tariff so they can protect their goods from foreign competition. Well, that's not what Tyler's for. He's a Southern Democrat to the core in that way, and he opposes a tariff. He thinks it's unconstitutional. A protective tariff is unconstitutional. He's a guy that was out there during the nullification crisis opposing Andrew Jackson's authority on that issue. He also opposes federally funded internal improvements. That's another plank of the Hamiltonian or American system. The idea that the federal government can spend money on selected projects in areas that only benefit perhaps one state or one small group of states. Well, that's not for the benefit of the union. It burdens all, but does not benefit all equally. So Tyler opposes that stuff. So the Whigs are irate. But again, Tyler's a Whig in the truest sense. He's a Whig in that he opposes strong central authority. So to Tyler, people like Clay and Jackson were just two shades of the same color. They both supported this very strong centralist system at the expense of the states. So this is why when you start talking about the Whig Party, and all the time, when you look at histories of the Whig Party, generally what you get are the Whigs are Henry Clay and Daniel Webster. Well, the Whigs were also John Tyler until this point. So this is really a transitionary period, as I said, because what the Whigs are going to do is unprecedented. They're going to kick Tyler out of the Whig Party. They hold a meeting. They say, look, Tyler's not one of us. All you states' rights Democrats, you need to get out of the Whig Party, basically. So from this point forward, the Whig Party loses that Southern element in some ways. Now, you still had some of the large planters who supported parts of the Hamiltonian system because they didn't care if they were selling their cotton to England or if they were selling their cotton to the Northeast. It didn't matter to them. For the most part, these Southern states' rights Democrats are gone. So now the Whig Party becomes another Hamiltonian party to the core. At that point, you can say the Whig Party was an extension of Alexander Hamilton. But to this point, to the Tyler presidency, there was always that faction there that was opposed to this kind of stuff. Now, it's also important to note that Tyler, when he tells his cabinet, look, I'm the guy. You can either agree with me or not, but I'm going to be running things. When he tells him that, all of his cabinet resigns. So here you have the entire cabinet gone. And this gives Tyler a chance to put his stamp on the executive branch. Now, the only guy that hung around for a little while was Daniel Webster, who was working on the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, which solidified a boundary between Canada and the United States. But then when he's finished with that, he's gone. Okay, Secretary of State, he's gone. So Tyler now has a chance to put all of his buddies in the executive branch. So he'll accept the resignations, and he'll appoint people like John C. Calhoun and Abel P. Upshur, people who are Southerners, states' rights guys like himself, to cabinet positions. So this is when the executive branch becomes really Southern at this point. And the states' rights faction of the Whig Party takes over in the executive branch. Again, Tyler's a man, though, without a party. And you could say that Calhoun really wasn't a Whig. He was marginally attached with the Whigs because of his opposition to Andrew Jackson. He never 100% supported the Whig Party because, frankly, he didn't really care for Henry Clay that much. But, so we have this new face to the, at least the Whig Party and the executive branch. Now, one of the most important guys in this new cabinet is Abel P. Upshur. Now, here's a guy you've probably never heard of in your entire life. And if you have, it's because you've read maybe some libertarian literature or been interested in that type of thing. But most Americans have never heard of Abel Parker Upshur. Again, another Virginian, one of Tyler's buddies. Upshur, in so many ways, was the leading constitutional scholar among the Southern states' rights Whigs. This is a guy that wrote a book directly refuting Joseph Story's version of the Constitution. And by Joseph Story's version of the Constitution, that would also be John Marshall's version of the Constitution and Alexander Hamilton's version of the Constitution, Daniel Webster's version of the Constitution. You can go down the line, Henry Clay's version of the Constitution, all these nationalists. He's going to directly refute this stuff. And the title of that book, I actually have it linked in the PowerPoint presentation that I provide for you. The title of the book is A Brief Inquiry into the True Nature of Our Federal Government. And I have it linked so you can go online and read it for free. This is fantastic stuff. If you really want to read a true defense of the Constitution in a states' rights position, you have to read Upshur, and you have to read this book. It's tremendous, fantastic stuff. He also supported the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions because he said this is an extension of states' rights, the 10th Amendment. He supports nullification. Now, Upshur is often demonized because he also defended slavery quite extensively. And of course he would. He was a man of the South. It was an institution that nobody had a problem with, really, in the South at the time. There were many Northerners who really didn't have a problem with it. That wasn't uncommon. But because of his defense of slavery and because he was this very conservative Southerner, he's often demonized today, or at least the way that you demonize him nowadays is just ignore him. The guy never existed. It's like he's dust in the wind and gone to history. But of course, we need to revisit this guy simply because of his constitutional prowess. I mean, this is a guy that understood the original compact between the states and said it very, very well. He also had an interesting death. He actually died in 1844 in an explosion on a ship, and it was a terrible, terrible accident. It's also how John Tyler eventually met his second wife, or at least fell in love, supposedly, the story goes, with his second wife. So Upshur is a really important guy. Tragically dies before his time. Now, if you talk about the Tyler administration, one of the most important things you're ever going to hear about John Tyler is Texas. Texas was the defining issue of Tyler's time in the executive branch. And it had been a goal of Americans for a very long time to annex Texas. Since Americans started settling in Texas, Americans had an interest in Texas. Texas, of course, in the 1840s, was an independent country. But we're going to have to talk about how Texas became independent. It's important to note how Americans got involved in Texas in the first place. So just to get a little background of Texas. Texas was actually part of Spain and Mexico in the 1820s. And when Mexico gained its independence in 1821, of course, Texas was part of Mexico. So for a time, Spain controlled Texas, and then, of course, Mexico controlled Texas. Now, it's also important to note in 1819, through something called the Adams-Onis Treaty, the United States apparently gave up its claims to Texas. So now Spain controlled it, and then, of course, Mexico. So theoretically, the United States has no claim to any territory in Texas. Now, Americans, however, were invited into Texas to settle there in the 1820s. But when Mexico gains its independence, the situation becomes a little more delicate because Mexico has a few different rules. For example, when Spain controlled Texas, Spain was perfectly fine with slaveholding in Texas. When Mexico becomes independent, slavery is abolished, ultimately. Mexico also is a little harder on things like gun rights and other issues like that, civil liberty issues. So the Texans who are going to settle there are eventually going to have a problem with the Mexican government. And there's going to be a very strained relationship. Now, one of the most important Texans in the history of American settlement there is a guy named Stephen Austin. Of course, Austin, Texas is named after him. He's often considered the father of Texas. And this is the guy that brought the first 300 families, American families, into Texas. Now, his father, Moses Austin, was the guy who was supposed to do this, but didn't work out for Moses Austin. So Stephen F. Austin brings the families into Texas in the 1820s. And they will settle there and establish themselves. And of course, they're settling in primarily eastern Texas, often called Green Texas. It's a very nice part of the state. They get a lot of rainfall. And of course, the type of agriculture and society that these Texans now are used to in the southern states is possible in eastern Texas. Well, by the 1830s, again, relationship between Texas and Mexico was extremely strained. Austin had gone to Mexico City to press claims of the Texan Americans there. He's actually put in prison for a time, and this is a very popular propaganda thing. You know, they actually say that Austin was put in a dungeon in Mexico City. He's put in prison for a time. And eventually, Texas has had enough. And so in 1836, they're going to declare their independence from Mexico, very much like the United States declared its independence from Great Britain in 1776. And the states individually, some of the states individually did that, of course. But Texas is going to do this in 1836. They write their own constitution, elect their own president. So Texas will now be an independent republic. They have their own army. Now, Mexico's not going to take too kindly to this. In fact, the dictator of Mexico at the time was a man named Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna. And Santa Anna is an important guy in Texas history. I mean, here's a Mexican history, I should say, also Texas history, but Mexican history. Here's a guy that was a military general, a dictator. I mean, if you talk about Mexican political history, and it's just this extremely turbulent, corrupt political history. Now, Santa Anna in the 1830s and 1840s is always front and center. So he's front and center here. And what he's going to do at this point, because he is essentially dictator of Mexico, is lead an army out to put down this Texan independence movement. He's not going to take too kindly to the fact that these rebel Texans are declaring their independence from this strong central authority. I mean, again, this is the American tradition, though. Secession, basically. And these Texans are saying, we've had enough of your tyrannical government, your strong, strong thumb on our neck, your strong-handed rule. We're gone. We're out of here. And no one in the United States blinked an eye at this stuff. Now, secession had been openly talked about as early as 1799 by Northerners. And, of course, it's talked about over and over again in U.S. history. And here are some Americans. Of course, they're in Texas now, and they're under the authority of Mexico, but still declaring their independence. This is the American tradition. This is what Americans do. The government becomes abusive. You declare your independence. You just get out of the government. It's not un-American to secede or declare your independence. In fact, it's the most American thing you can do. Now, Santa Anna, again, is going to march into Texas. The Texan forces were actually commanded by Sam Houston. And, of course, Sam Houston, by the 1840s, is a household name in America, but this is really where he gets his name, in his 1836 defense of Texan independence. He's an American hero, and a lot of people don't realize him, or at least recognize him, realize that or recognize him as that fact. But Houston had a little different perspective on what he was going to do with Santa Anna. His idea was not to let Santa Anna dictate the terms of engagement. He was going to try to dictate them himself. And in 1836, he's going to require the service of all able-bodied men in Texas to fight this war for independence. Now, he had some forces stationed at a little Spanish mission called the Alamo, which is now in San Antonio, Texas. Now, the Alamo had changed hands a number of times, and it really didn't have any significance. It was a Spanish mission that was never completed, but it had a little garrison there, a little fort. And this is where Santa Anna thought that Sam Houston was. He thought he was at the Alamo. He's going to move to the Alamo, take it, and put an end to this Texan independence movement once and for all. Well, Sam Houston leaves, and the garrison that's at the Alamo doesn't believe that Santa Anna is going to go there. They believe that Santa Anna is going to chase Sam Houston. Well, unfortunately for them, Santa Anna shows up in February of 1836, and he keeps getting reinforcements. And this very small garrison, that numbers in the hundreds, now has to defend the Alamo against thousands of Mexican soldiers. And this is going to be a fight to the death, and a fight that they're not going to win. But this is one of the most heroic stories in American history. Again, a story you don't hear much about. I know that Disney just remade a movie with Billy Bob Thornton playing Davy Crockett a few years back, but it bombed at the box office. Americans just seem don't care about this stuff. But and perhaps that's because it's not politically correct to like the Alamo anymore, Texan independence movement. But this is a really interesting story in American history. So the Alamo, again, it's just a little old Spanish mission, not important in any way, except this important battle in Texas, the Texas independence movement takes place here. A couple of the important guys at the Alamo. One guy was named James Bowie. He was, of course, a hero of the Alamo, co-commander of the fort that was protecting the mission. He's also legendary because of his very famous Bowie knife, but this very large knife that he carried. But Bowie, if you read the accounts of what happened here, the man was extremely sick during this Battle of the Alamo, and he was actually killed in his bed, stabbed to death while he was trying to defend himself. So what you can say about the attack of the Alamo is that these Mexican soldiers had no quarter for these men here. And they warned them ahead of time that would be the case. But every single soldier who fought at the Battle of the Alamo is going to be killed by this Mexican army. Another important American at this time was a man named William Barrett Travis. Now, William Barrett Travis was from Claiborne, Alabama. And if you see some of the portrayals of Travis in movies, he's often seen as this guy that's not very smart. A lot of people don't like him. He actually was a lawyer. And he left Alabama not because of infidelity on his part, but because his wife perhaps was not faithful to him. And of course, the son that he claimed may not have been his own son. So he leaves Alabama, goes to Texas to start over. He is the leader of the forces at the Alamo in 1836. And when he realizes the situation, there's this very famous line in the sand that he draws. And he says, look, anyone who doesn't want to support the defense of the Alamo is free to leave, just cross the line and go. And only one man does so. So the men who stayed and defended the Alamo understood the cost of this defense, that it was going to probably cost them their lives, but they were willing to do it to defend this stronghold in their mind in this Texas independence movement. In fact, Travis is going to write a very famous letter trying to get reinforcements. And I'm going to read this portion of this letter to you because I think it really exemplifies the American spirit and the American tradition. He said, "Fellow citizens and compatriots, I am besieged by 1,000 or more of the Mexicans under Santa Ana. I have sustained a continual bombardment in Canada for 24 hours and have not lost a man. The enemy has demanded a surrender at discretion. Otherwise, the garrison are to be put to the sword if the fort is taken. I have answered the demand with a cannon shot, and our flag still waves proudly from the walls. I shall never surrender or retreat. Then I call on you in the name of liberty, of patriotism, and everything dear to the American character to come to our aid with all dispatch. The enemy is receiving reinforcements daily and will no doubt increase to 3,000 or 4,000 in 4 or 5 days. If this call is neglected, I am determined to stay myself as long as possible and die like a soldier who never forgets what is due to his own honor and that of his country. Victory or death. William Barrett Travis, Lieutenant Colonel Commanding." So, a couple of things that are important in this. You know, he's saying that the American spirit is liberty, patriotism, and of course, independence. Liberty, independence, they're one and the same. And so he's fighting for that, and he's dying for that. Another, of course, important hero at the Battle of the Alamo was Davy Crockett. Oftentimes, you know, if you grew up in the 50s and 60s, and, Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, well, he was there. And, he's one of these guys, and of course, in American history, again, he's kind of been swept aside. Not really an American hero. He's not important because he fought Indians. But this guy in the 1830s was a hero. He was well known across the United States, you know, folk hero, so to speak. He was kind of the extension of Daniel Boone. People thought this frontiersman was, you know, exemplified the American character, you know, independent spirit. He had served as a congressman and, had opposed the Washington elite in D.C. A lot of people thought, you know, this was an American. Of course, he's also going to be killed at the Alamo in defense of the fort, as, again, were every soldier. And then, of course, their bodies were all burned. Now, the Battle of the Alamo actually takes place between February 23rd and March 6, 1836. So these Texans were able to hold out for a number of days, even though they're tremendously outnumbered, you know, almost 10 to 1. 2,400 Mexican soldiers against about 200 Texas soldiers defending this fort. So it's really surprising that these men were actually able to sustain themselves as long as they did. However, they also killed 600 Mexican soldiers as well. So they did a fairly good job in the defense of the fort, but ultimately it will fall. And so the battle cry then for the Texan independence movement becomes, "Remember the Alamo." And of course, from here, Santa Anna is going to march out from the Alamo after he kills every soldier defending the Alamo, and he'll march out, and he'll actually kill more Texans at something called the Massacre of Goliad, where 300 Texans were put to the sword. So Santa Anna is a pretty brutal guy, and nobody likes this guy in Texas, to say the least. And of course, he gains this terrible reputation during this process. Now, the war for Texan independence will ultimately end at something called the Battle of San Jacinto in 1836. Sam Houston had led Santa Anna on a wild goose chase, so to speak. He makes him split his army. Santa Anna has dropped his artillery at one point because he can't keep moving them. Sam Houston is moving very quickly. And the objective, again, was to pick the spot to fight Santa Anna, to pick the location of the battle so that he had the upper hand. And he does that very well here at San Jacinto. Santa Anna is caught completely by surprise, and it only takes 18 minutes to defeat his army. Now, the old story goes that Santa Anna actually was distracted at this time. And this goes back to the very famous song called "The Yellow Rose of Texas." Apparently, the Yellow Rose of Texas was a very beautiful woman in Texas, and she had done her best to distract Santa Anna during the battle, and so he was not aware that the battle was even taking place at the beginning. And of course, he's ultimately captured and has to surrender Texas and give Texas its independence. So Texas will then be an independent country from 1836 to 1845. And during this period, you had a tremendous call for the annexation of Texas to the United States. Now, there's a little problem with that. Texas, of course, is a slaveholding state, or it would have been a slaveholding state, and there was a fear that you could have carved out a number of states out of Texas. So northern abolitionists and also people who would play on this issue didn't want Texas brought into the Union because it would upset this balance of power in the United States. You'd have more slave states, and these New Englanders were not necessarily interested in that because, of course, that would curtail their power. So they don't want Texas, and they're going to put a roadblock up every chance they get in bringing Texas into the Union, not because of some moral qualms about slavery, but because they didn't want the South to have another state that would upset the balance of power. Well, Tyler, of course, wants Texas, and he's going to achieve the annexation of Texas in 1845 through a joint resolution of Congress. Now, the important thing to note here is that 1844, of course, is an election year, and the man who's running for president and the Democrats, James K. Polk, has already made Texas a campaign issue. So Texas is going to come into the Union no matter what if Polk is elected, and he was elected. So Tyler just accomplishes something that was going to happen anyways. Now, the question is, was this constitutional? Can the United States just bring in a state through a joint resolution? There's nothing in the Constitution that says they can. There's nothing in the Constitution that says they can't. So this is the one area where maybe Tyler was seen as inconsistent, a guy that supports the Constitution as written, but yet is willing to work beyond that to get Texas into the Union. And not through a treaty, but through a simple joint resolution of